I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Charles Lindbergh, Jimmy Doolittle, Eddie Rickenbacker, Carl Spatz may be familiar to you, especially if you are up on your aviation history. What about Harold Harris? Today we talk about this man who much of history has forgotten, an Air Force Brigadier General who was one of the most distinguished pilots, holding 26 flying records. He died at the age of 92 in 1988 at his home in Falmouth. Alta Mae Stevens is author of And Then What Happened? Harold Harris and the Early Development of Aviation. She joins us in studio, and this book is near and dear to your heart because Harold Harris was your father.
That's right.
So he devoted his career to both military and civilian aviation, participating in changes in aviation almost over eight decades. He was one of the nation's first test pilots. How is it that many of us have not heard his name mentioned among the other great pilots of the day?
This is a question that has arisen very frequently, and it was the main reason for my writing the book. I think that Justin Libby, who has written more and more authoritatively about our father than anybody else, hit the nail on the head when he said he thought that maybe Harold Harris was just modest. Mm. He didn't like to blow his own horn. And also, he was very interested in team playing rather than acting as the star.
And we're going to get into some of the many accomplishments, but before we do that, let's sort of set the scene and start with early aviation. This really began with balloons.
It did begin with balloons, and it began in the 18th century. I guess the most famous balloonists in those days were the Montgolfier brothers in France, in Paris, and they created these beautiful paper balloons, which were filled with air and not with either helium or hydrogen. It was much later that the balloons got sophisticated and people began to use them for transport or for spying purposes, which is something to think about. This was true in the Civil War.
Right. And, of course, Count von Zeppelin began experimenting with rigid airship design in the 1890s, which led to the Zeppelins in the 1900, which really became a worldwide craze.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was very financially remunerative for the company, too, for the nation, at a time when Germany needed a lot of morale building. They got it through their famous Zeppelins. And, of course, we all know what happened finally with the Hindenburg when they used very flammable hydrogen instead of what is used commonly now, helium. And the whole thing went up in flames in New Jersey.
Right. It was 1910 that Harold played hooky from school to attend the first National Aviation Air Show outside of Los Angeles. So this love of aviation and flying was something he had as a young boy.
Yes, basically he was an engineer. And he, for example, he was very interested in automobiles and how they worked. It was a period when aviation was beginning to grab hold of people's thoughts. Mm. And people were realizing that perhaps, with the Wright brothers, people were realizing for the first time that maybe people could be carried safely 100,000 feet overhead from one spot to another. This is a remarkable phenomenon. So, yes, a new era was in force at that time.
Yeah, you can see where a 10-year-old boy would be pretty excited
about
that possibility.
It was very exciting,
yeah.
Yes.
Let's talk about his parents. You write about your grandparents. Harold's father, Ross Allen Harris, he had this anxiety about his children's health.
He had everybody in glasses. That was beginning. And then second of all, he was, of course, very devoted Congregationalist. And he was also a typical Victorian patriarch. And so there was this side of Ross Allen that was absolutely rock solid as far as religion was concerned. And the sad part is, as my Aunt Jessica used to recount, was that after many years of attending a particular church whose new pastor was a Unitarian, Ross Allen, when he discovered that the new pastor did not believe in the divinity of Jesus, marched his family out of the church that they had been attending for 25 years and never allowed them to return.
And he was always worried that there was some health problem with his children. And, of course, with your father, Harold, he forbid him to play football because he thought he'd
That's correct.
Yeah. And actually, when he went away to college, he said, do not join a fraternity and do not play football. And, of course, your dad did both.
And so did his sister. Well, his sister didn't play football, but he told Harold's sister not to join a sorority, and she did, and she shouldn't ever dance, and she did. So, yes, she thought, she laughed later, many, many years later, and said, oh, we could have all gone to hell.
Now, I mentioned Jimmy Doolittle at the beginning of the program, and he and Harold Harris were about the same age, and you're right, were both speed freaks when young, but Doolittle was the real daredevil.
Oh, yes. He absolutely was. And the famous anecdote that our father used to tell was about how he rode his motorcycle between the streetcars, that one coming and one going. And he didn't think anything of it. And the famous thing that happened many years later when in Buenos Aires, we don't know exactly why he was in such a hurry to get out of that apartment, but maybe it had something to do with the lady who was living inside. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he fell off the balcony, I don't know how many stories up, and survived. He was a real daredevil. Yeah.
All right, so along comes Grace Clark, and you write, the biographies of great men seldom have more than a passing reference to their wives, certainly in one way or another their most important relationship. In the case of Harold R. Harris, there is no doubt that as a complement to his need to explore and create, in Grace Clark, he found a beautiful woman whose intelligence, creativity, and inner steel matched his own, and who, despite continuing ill health, ultimately became an unrelenting watchdog over his career.
That's absolutely true. She was an unrelenting watchdog over my brother and me, too.
So this was a good match.
In many ways, it was. I mean, it must have been really tough being married to my dad, because he was always off adventuring in very dangerous places, doing very dangerous things.
Yeah, because we think back, this is the beginning of aviation, and certainly we didn't have the safety.
His cohorts had to make it up as they went along. Mm-hmm. And that was the beauty for him, because he talked about the time in Dayton. He wrote this letter from when he was stationed in Dayton at the air installation. And he was talking about this plane that was so bulky, and he didn't know what to do with it, so he thought he'd just replace the motor. Well, you can't do that these days.
That's right.
Especially without permission.
So Harold, he learns to fly, and he was shipped out with 75 other American pilots to Italy in 1917. And he obviously was a quick study, because he quickly graduated to flying instructor. And you got to remember, this is a time where, as you say, they're kind of, you know, learning as you go, learning as you do.
Absolutely.
And you tell a funny story about Fiorello LaGuardia, who would later become the mayor of New York.
Well, why don't you tell it, Mindy?
Well, you tell it better than I do. This is where he's flying. They land, and the two of them are yelling at each other. Let me see if I can.
Daddy, he was a good friend, became a very good friend of LaGuardia. And at this point, he was just a spectator watching LaGuardia and this Italian pilot in this biplane. And it started to come in for a landing. It was a very rocky landing. Harold couldn't understand why it was such a bad landing. Well, as soon as the plane pulled to a stop, they both jumped out, and being Italian, they started waving their hands and yelling at each other. Well, it turns out that each thought that the other one had landed the plane.
Oh, that's funny. Now, your dad was pretty calm under pressure.
Oh, extremely. Yes.
Was that just something that was innate in him? He just had that knack?
He inherited that from his mom, I'm absolutely sure. And I don't know whether I want to take up your time talking about the anecdote that his mother
experienced. Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Oh, when she was a college student, she was at Wheaton in Illinois. It was a summer day, summer evening, maybe early fall. And she was sitting in her room reading. And all of a sudden, there was a rustle outside where the landing was of the window, and she looked up, and this man jumped into her room. So she was alarmed and stood up, and to face him, And he came after her with a knife. And he said, God has told me to kill you today. She was astounded, but she didn't move a muscle. She just stood there staring at him. And in a very calm voice, she said, oh, no, you're wrong. God didn't tell you to kill me today. He told you to kill me tomorrow. Well, the man was very upset because he had this idea in his mind that he had a job to do. So he thought about it, and finally he turned around and went back down out the window, down the fire escape, and she was able to live another day. Mm. It turned out that he was an escapee from an insane asylum and that was nearby. But this woman should do that.
Right. Who would have the who thought would to have do that, right? Yeah.
Who would have the coolness to face up to that?
And so your dad obviously had that same type of coolness. And one example of that is where he decides to try to fly into a cloud.
Yep. He was always embarrassed about that. The plane, for some reason, reversed it. It turned itself over. So he was basically saved from falling out of the airplane by his seatbelt. And he was sure that this was going to be the end of his life, but he struggled as well as he could. And finally, he turned the plane over so that it was flying correctly. But,
Tells you something about the seatbelts, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
As you say, we learn all these little safety measures as we go along. So after the war, he became a test pilot, and he flew in some pretty amazing aircraft. And again, we have to think back to what these times were and the aircraft that they were flying. And these test pilots, you know, every time they go up, they're taking their life into their hands.
Oh, yeah. Daddy had an anecdote that was really sort of horrifying to think about. In the early days, they had these air races. People would be encouraged, well, like the first one that he and Jimmy Doolittle went to, the air show outside of Los Angeles. And they would be encouraged to fly either around these pylons, either very fast or very slow, whichever way it was really serious and very dangerous. There was one occasion when our father was watching. He did not participate at this particular point. And the pilot who was flying this plane crashed. There was a huge audience, and as soon as they saw him crash, all these people ran across to where the airplane was, and seeing the dead pilot, they began stripping the buttons off of his jacket as souvenirs, which shows two things. A, that these pilots were demigods at the time, and B, that people had no real understanding of how dangerous their occupation was.
Right. So he flew an enormous triplane called the Barling Bomber. this is crazy when you think about it. Okay, so this plane, it weighed 27,132 pounds empty. So its gross weight was 42,000 some odd pounds. It could reach 95.5 miles per hour. It cost $500,000 to construct and required a special hangar because it was so large, right?
That's true.
And I guess it became a bit of a problem, so it was sort of quietly destroyed in 1928.
Yeah, well, they wanted to have it flown to Washington, and it couldn't make its way over the mountains, so they decided to quietly do away with it without anybody noticing.
So then, and Harold was the first and maybe the only pilot to fly the GAX. Tell us about the GAX.
Oh, the GAX. Everybody warned him. Before he took off, you know, everybody would take him aside.
There's a photo in there. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's a triplane. It was just an enormous armored beast, and there was everything wrong with it. And as I say, I don't have the quotation now. But.
Oh, so here, I have it here. Let's see. It says that he became the first and maybe the only pilot to fly the beast. He recalls, this was a triplane with twin Liberty engines, 420 horsepower each, complete armor around each engine, and the portion of the fuselage occupied by the crew, pilot, and gunner. One 37-millimeter cannon swiveled forward and four Lewis guns in the floor of the armored section firing vertically down. To protect the engine water cooling, ribbon radiators were constructed above each engine, protected by the armor around the engine. I had a battle with the designer since I felt the engine would not cool. He was sure it would as soon as we got flying and air flowed above the engines. Guess not so much. Your father was right.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was everything wrong with it. And everybody told him, well, what was it? Another engineer told him to be careful landing because he might break down the gear, the landing gear. And it just went on. And everybody did this and sort of whispered aside so nothing would leak out to the press. And, of course, as soon as Daddy took off, the water cooling didn't work. It boiled over.
He just barely
made it over the hedge nearby and managed to land successfully, but nobody knows how or why.
We're talking with Alta Mae Stevens. Her book is And Then What Happened? Harold Harris and the Early Development of Aviation. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Alta Mae Stevens. Her book is And Then What Happened? Harold Harris and the Early Development of Aviation. This is your dad, Harold Harris is your dad, as we were talking. He was the first to fly in a pressurized cabin. Again, going back to this with these advances that we have in aviation, he was there for so much of it, as we mentioned, 8 decades. But talk about that experience of the pressurized cabin. That was a bit harrowing.
Our father wasn't the only person who was concerned about the unpleasant conditions under which people had to fly. In the first place, there was no oxygen for people who were passengers. And in the second place, it was darn cold. It seemed as though pressurizing the cabin was the only way to solve these problems. So they equipped a biplane, as I recall. Well, maybe it was a monoplane, with an artificially constructed enclosed cabin. It was very small. It was relatively small. Our father was a fairly sizable man, so he had to wear sneakers to maintain control of the controls.
Right.
So what happened was he took off in this airplane that was constructed specifically for the purpose of being able to pressurize the cabin where he was operating. And the pressure got out of hand. He was lucky to land the plane. He couldn't get out even if he wanted to. So finally he did. He took his shoe, as I can recall, and banged with it on the lock and was able to get out. It was a matter of nearly losing his life because the pressure was so intense.
Yeah. It's a scary thing, when you think about this. He also was the first to make an emergency parachute jump.
Oh, yeah. His main claim to fame, and so it's sort of something that we accept and wish that he was famous for other things, too. But yes, that's true. He and his best friend, Fairchild, Lieutenant Fairchild, this was when they were stationed in Dayton, and he had to test this monoplane. In those days, the only safe way to fly a plane was if it had two wings and what they call a biplane. He was going to test a monoplane, a plane that was one-winged. And so they decided what they would do. They would take off and fly around and do sort of mock combat. And when he started to make a turn, his ailerons started to give way. And then the whole plane sort of fell apart. Fortunately, before he had gotten into the plane, he had put on a parachute, which is... In those days, it was highly unusual for pilots to wear parachutes, but he decided he would. It was too small for him, and it was uncomfortable over his heavy flying suit, but he put it on anyway as a last-minute thought. And you've got to remember that in those days, parachutes weren't mandatory, and actually any kind of protective headgear wasn't mandatory either. Finally, they did make the protective headgear mandatory, but they never quite got around to making parachutes mandatory until people like my dad had these terrible experiences. So he finally managed to jump out of the plane, and the plane was falling apart anyway. His friend Fairchild, his good friend Fairchild, had landed in the meantime, and he was standing with Jimmy Doolittle, watching this whole thing happening and seeing his friend come out of the airplane and being absolutely sure that he would be killed. My father had this experience of falling thousands of feet, not losing consciousness, finding that he was falling head first, trying to reverse that, so he finally got in the right direction and then pulling on the ripcord to find out that nothing happened and the parachute didn't open, and he tried four times. Finally, on the fourth time, when he was quite close to the ground, his parachute opened up, mm-hmm. and he fell into a grape arbor. And trying to control the plane, the joystick, the thing that he used to operate the plane and the throttle, had bashed against his legs very severely. And that was really the worst part of the whole operation, because he was quite damaged because of that. But the thing that really bothered him was the fact that in those days, the military made officers pay for their own trousers, their own uniforms. Mm-hmm. And his uniform was pretty well shredded.
He had to buy a new one.
He knew he couldn't afford another one. So this is the thing that bothered him more than anything else. He fell into a grape arbor in the 80s in Dayton. They established an aviation trail.
Oh.
And so they put a new stop on the aviation trail for where our father fell into the grape arbor. And I was with him on this trip when he went out to give a speech and accept the installation of the new spot on the trail. So the photographers were there, and the reporters were there, and it was really exciting. And this man came up to our dad and said, General Harris, you won't recognize me, but I'm the little boy who saw you fall into the grape arbor. We lived across the street. And I turned to my mom and I said, what should I do? And she said, well, take him a glass of water. So I took you a glass of water, and while you were sitting there in the grape arbor, you drank it. And I was so thrilled at that whole episode, because I thought, isn't that amazing how people remember these things?
Right. Let's go to 1925. This is a fateful year for American aviation. Tell us about the Morrow Board testimony.
That was really interesting, and I have to thank Jim Hoogerwerth, who has written about the origins of Delta, who told me about this one. The American government was very slow to do anything about commercial aviation. And Billy Mitchell didn't want to have commercial aviation without being under the guidance and protection of the military. Billy Mitchell, unfortunately, was in a very bad, had a very bad reputation with Congress at the time, though. So Congress passed an act authorizing commercial aviation and authorizing the U.S. Post Office to subsidize it. One of the reasons that all this happened so quickly and so well was because of the testimony of our dad and other people before the Morrow Board to prove that commercial aviation was financially viable. And this was based on his experience as a general manager of the Huff DeLand Cotton Dusting Company.
Let's talk about that for a second. His participation in crop dusting. And this kind of, as you said, sort of leads to the birth of commercial airlines. We had this boll weevil issue with, wasn't it boll weevils that
yes,
were destroying
absolutely.
Some crops?
Penetrated the cotton in the South. Yeah, and we're doing millions and millions of dollars worth of damage. And it was very labor-intensive to spray. They knew they had to spray. It was labor-intensive to spray on the ground. Very slow, and it seemed as though it would be more efficient if they could spray from the air. Mm-hmm. A man by the name of C.E. Woolman, who later became the father of Delta Airlines, who was an entomologist, with a man by the name of Code, ran the spraying section of the U.S. government. And they had tried spraying other things, catalpa trees, for example, in the Midwest, very successfully. So the military decided to try it and other things. And C.E. Woolman got a bee in his bonnet and decided that they could be commercially successful if they taught farmers that it was cheaper in the long run to spray from the air rather than spraying by hand on the ground.
Right. So your dad was one of the few that went, you know, this could be the future here. People traveling on planes. He was one of those visionaries who could see that coming. And that it's interesting, the connection with the mail service, because obviously this started as they wanted to get the mail to its destinations. And this is where we came up with night flying.
Well, night flying began actually in Italy. Daddy was doing night flying on a regular basis in Italy. It was just slow to be adopted in the United States. But other things did result from the interest of the post office. Mm-hmm. And one thing was lighted airfields. Daddy and a friend were responsible for instituting a test route that was lighted at night so that the mail could be carried 24 hours a day, presumably. And for airmail, which they charge a surcharge for, it was really important that the mail get through in a timely fashion. So that was a very important thing. They had beacons. That later on came beacons and all sorts of impedimenta around the airfields that hadn't been there originally. That was really important. Actually, in a way, the lighting was more important than the night flying.
Mm, yeah. Oh, for sure. Let's talk about Pan American Grace Airways. This was a deal between Pan Am and the Grace Steamship Line. So talk about your dad's involvement in that and why South America?
The Hof de Land Dusting Company was hired by a Peruvian outfit to come and dust for cotton in Peru and Ecuador. They did, and it was such a tremendous success that Daddy decided, while he was down there supervising the dusting, he didn't fly dusters himself, but he did teach people how to fly dusters. While he was down there, he decided that he would just look around because he had kind of the beginnings of a real dream. And he nosed around these various countries and asked them how they managed to provide transportation, how they managed to get the word out about what they wanted to sell. And he discovered that they were all very receptive to the idea of having air transport, which was fairly unusual at the time. So he drew up a map, which became very historic, of the places that could be turned into landing fields between, say, Lima, Peru, and the Canal Zone. He produced this map for financial interests who were allied with Juan Trippe, who was dreaming of having an airline down the east coast of South America.
And Juan Trippe was the head of Pan Am.
Well, he invented Pan Am. Mm-hmm. Pan Am started as a mail route from Cuba to the Keys and went on from there. He's a very ambitious man.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
So Harris talked to Juan Trippe and his financial people, and they said, oh, well, we were thinking about this a long time ago. Ha, ha, ha. And so, but he was also interested, got the interest of the Grace Steamship Line. And the Grace Steamship Line had originally wanted to hire him to start an airline under their operation. And so they were really quite miffed when they heard that he'd gone to Trippe. But finally it all worked out that the Grace Steamship and Pan Am went in halves
50-50
to back this company.
Yeah. And that's not what Trippe wanted. Trippe wanted controlling interest, but the Grace Steamship Line said, nope, we want 50%. So it was 50-50 was the deal.
They had 50-50, but the idea was that Pan Am was to supply the aircraft and the personnel initially, and the steamship line was to supply the diplomatic connections and everything else that had to be done to ease the beginning of the airline. It was not a happy marriage, though, no, between the two. And because Trippe always maintained that Panagra was just a branch of Pan Am, and the steamship line said, no, 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 it was a completely different operation.
We're talking with Alta Mae Stevens. Her book is And Then What Happened? Harold Harris and the Early Development of Aviation. We'll talk more after a quick break. We're talking with Alta Mae Stevens, author of And Then What Happened? Harold Harris and the Early Development of Aviation. So you have a chapter about flying across South America in the 20s, and you begin with a quote. This was an era of those daring young men in their flying machines when almost no one had flown. To fly was glamorous, rare, maybe even a bit dangerous. In South America, it was macho. Not surprisingly, every dictator on the continent wanted to do it or be seen shaking hands with those who did.
Oh, absolutely. That's a quote from Bill Cruzan, who wrote a wonderful book about flying the Andes. It was extremely dangerous and extremely difficult. in the early days when they had only Fairchilds, which was a monoplane with a single engine, no pressurization, no oxygen, very little room. They carried, what, four or five passengers to begin with. These Fairchilds were not equipped to fly the enormous heights that they would. They ended up flying to cross the Andes. And it's just amazing how these pilots were skillful enough and how my father had enough faith to send these little tiny planes up against these, to go over these mountains. You've got to remember that the tallest, the Andes chain went down, it exactly bisected South America. The highest mountain, Mount Aconcagua, was over 22,000 feet. And the Fairchilds were routinely made to fly at least 12,000 feet to go through the passes. But this was not on their book.
You know what I find amazing about this is that in all this time that these planes, all these trips, there was only one fatal plane crash.
Well, it was the first.
Right, yeah.
No, there were fatal plane crashes, but that was the first.
But it was after your dad set
the pattern for requiring better communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the politics, because as you're saying, we have these different leaders, different countries, and they all have their own rules.
They all hated each other, for starters. And they were always engaged in some sort of a border war. And also, the other problem was that, for example, in Peru, Lima became the base for Pinagra. In Peru, they kept on either assassinating or simply getting rid of their presidents, so-called presidents. When Pinagra was established as a active airline, Sanchez Cerro, for example, who was a refined thug, who took control of and became president, decided at one point that he was going to start a war, because one good way to keep popular is if you started a war with somebody. So he started a border war, and he decided that he really had to acquire Pinagra's planes in his war effort. So he summoned our father to the palace at night, and Daddy didn't know Spanish that well, and told him face to face that Daddy would have to give up all of his planes because he needed them to fight this war, which was something that he'd created sort of out of a whole cloth. Daddy didn't know what to do. He decided that the best thing was to just argue him down to one plane, which he did. And so that plane was donated to the Peruvian Air Force, and it was immediately crashed by a Peruvian pilot. And the other planes were left more or less intact. But that was just one of the many episodes in which, the nations, I shouldn't denigrate the nations by saying that they were irresponsible. No, it's just that there weren't any rules for these things, and they were aware that they were open to exploitation by foreign powers, especially the United States.
Yeah. So your parents moved to Lima in 1928, just before you were born, and they stayed until 1939 when your father was transferred to Pinagra's New York office, and that was something he wasn't happy about. He didn't want to go to New York.
He didn't want to, but he had a son who nearly died twice of amoebic dysentery. Mm. There were a lot of germs, and there were no antibiotics.
It was best, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned, Pinagra didn't get much help from Pan Am, and it was 1942, your dad joined the Air Transport Command as a colonel. He resigned from Pinagra.
Right? That's correct.
And so tell us a little about the Air Transport Command days.
The years when Daddy was with the Air Transport Command, it was very important that he get Havana cigars to the wife of the president of Iceland. And the way to do it, of course, was not by ship, because the German subs were too efficient. Mm. So they had to fly. And this was one of the responsibilities of the Air Transport Command, to provide Havana cigars for the wife of the president of Iceland, which I found extremely funny.
Hmm. How long was he there?
During the war, throughout the war. Mm-hmm. And while he was in the Air Transport Command, he made some good friends. And one of them was C.R. Smith, who was the president of American Airlines. Mm. And C.R. Smith was so taken by my dad that after the war, he hired him to head up an airline that C.R. had invented, which is called American Overseas Airline, which came from his purchase of something called American Export.
Mm.
And so Daddy became head of American Overseas Airlines, mainly because of his association with C.R. Smith.
Right. And before that, he was instrumental in the formation of the International Air Transport Association.
That's correct.
Tell us what that is.
When he was, that was so important. And there's a wonderful anecdote associated with that. This was after World War II, naturally. People in the aviation business were realizing that this was, in the United States, were realizing increasingly that this was not, the challenge was not domestic. The challenge was international. And the problem was that they had to establish rules for international transport, which had never been terribly necessary before on. There was a conference. They organized a conference. Daddy was there. Fiorello LaGuardia was there as mayor of New York. And there is a lovely picture taken of the two of them sitting next to each other. And the only anecdote I have for the establishment of IATA, which is kind of foreboding right now, is the fact that is the one that discussed the participation and abrupt departure of the Russian delegation. And this was because one of the leaders of the conference began talking about the airlines having the profit motive. The Russians had no idea what that was. So, but they were sure that it was probably something that they didn't approve of. So they walked out, and they never did take part in the creation of the International Air Transport Association.
So it was September 1950 in a letter to the AOA Board of Directors that he submitted his resignation.
Well, that was extremely sad, and I felt really bad about that because Daddy was always creating airlines and then having them sold out
from under him,
and that's what happened with AOA. C.R. Smith got tired of operating two airlines, one domestic and one international, so he sold the international one to Juan Trippe.
Mm-hmm. Our ambitious Juan Trippe is back on the scene.
He wanted to make sure he wanted to make sure that his was the chosen instrument. That's the way that worked out.
Yeah, you've got a great, I'm going to just read from that just before you talk about his resignation. I'm reminded of the relationship between the trainer of a racehorse and the animal's actual owner. The trainer can affect the destiny of the horse on the track, but it is up to the owner to assure the animal's actual future. Harold Harris was the trainer who created a winner only to see it sold out from under him.
Absolutely. And the sad part was Daddy was very good at not just organizing airlines, but also organizing the employees of airlines, motivating them, talking to them, explaining to them, discussing with them, listening to them. Mm-hmm. And I found that quite remarkable. And he was also, the other thing that he was very strong on, and these two things he pushed in AOA and wherever he was operating, the other thing was the safety feature. He was very involved with the Flight Safety Foundation from its very inception. The person who created it was his best friend. Mm. And so these two factors together, I was very impressed by.
Yeah. Let's talk about his time at Northwest Air.
Oh, that was, it's interesting because this has all come out now because a gentleman did some research who is associated with doing PR for Northwest Airlines. And he did some research in Dayton at the archives at the Wright State University, where my father's archives are. And he was very thorough. He went through and he read all of the memos, all of the reports, everything like that. And he figured that Daddy had been given the equivalent of a bum's rush.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was that he was elected president of Northwest Airlines, got a lot of energy going. Northwest was in a fairly bad situation at the time, got a lot of energy going, got a lot of new ideas. He wanted to locate the very small cadre of administrators in New York City and away from the Midwest, where traditionally Northwest had always been centered in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. But he would leave the maintenance and so forth was going to stay in the Minneapolis area. This was not intended to move the company to New York. It was intended to sort of get the people who made policy away from the sort of hurly-burly. Mm. And besides, New York was the center of the universe at the time. Right. All the other airlines were there. The Pan Am building oversaw Park Avenue. It was, you know, it was the place to be. So the rumor got around, and the man who wrote this article that he sent me recently, the rumor got around, and it was probably pushed by the man who succeeded our dad as president of Northwest. The rumor got around that they were going to move the whole company to New York. And faithful Minnesotans didn't like that. And the character of the board of directors changed somewhat. There were a few financial interests from Wall Street that were interested in the bottom line and not in the creation of an airline. You've got to remember that airlines have never really operated at much of a profit. It's always been a struggle, which is why the subsidies were so important.
So he was out.
So he was out. And he had a very serious heart attack. So they told him, I think, when he was in the hospital, and with no preliminary notice or anything like that. They told the press first. Mm. And he had five more years to run on his contract. And so he was out. It always bothered me. I couldn't understand why, because he had been doing such a good job, and the airline had been making money.
Yeah. So this was helpful information.
But you see, what happened was the airline made a lot of money, but the stocks fell.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the stocks fell, that was the bottom line for the Wall Street people.
Right, exactly.
So that's one reason I wrote the book, because I wanted to discuss this whole operation, which had been so murky. And then this gentleman who, as I say, sent me this article that he'd just written, he's a PR person for Northwest, but it didn't make any difference.
Yeah.
He decided he would tell the truth, straighten the story. The story was that Harold Harris was an incompetent, and that's why they got rid of him.
And that was not the truth.
And that was not the truth. The truth was that forces probably instigated by the man who succeeded him, were interested in spreading false rumors.
How did your dad feel about all this? Was he bitter? Did he talk about it?
He never said anything bad about anybody. My mother was the one who was always up in arms.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because even all the photos I was telling you, the picture with him in his uniform, you know, here's this general, and usually they're looking very stern, and he's got this nice little smirk, you know, this kind of sweet smile on his face. And you've probably seen, there's an interview on YouTube that he did in the 1950s on a television show, and he's just that calm, collected, just seemed like the nicest guy.
He was.
Yeah.
He certainly wanted to win. As I said in my introduction, I never played a card game with him that he didn't win, and he would always laugh, which I thought was really rotten of him to do.
Well, it's a great book, and it's really interesting to sort of reminisce and go back and look at all the advances we've had in aviation history, and your dad being so much a part of that for 80 years, almost 80 years. The book is And Then What Happened? Harold Harris and the Early Development of Aviation. Alta Mae Stevens, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your dad's story.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.